That line supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr once again storm the parliament building in the capital's heavily fortified green zone. Russia's energy giant Gazprom suspends its gas supplies to Latvia as after slashing deliveries to Germany amid tensions with the West. And Iran and China say they will speed up the implementation of a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement amid strengthening economic and political ties. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisum Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Thousands of supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have stormed the parliament in the capital Baghdad's green zone. The protesters earlier breached the heavily fortified zone, which houses government buildings and foreign embassies. Security forces have sealed off Baghdad roads leading to the green zone with massive blocks of concrete. Sadr supporters oppose the recently announced nomination of Mohammed al-Sudani for prime minister. He is a former human rights minister and ex-provincial governor. On Wednesday, Sadr supporters also occupied the parliament building before leaving 2 hours later upon his orders. Moving on, Russia has suspended gas supplies to Latvia amid tensions with the West over the Ukraine conflict. In a statement, the company cited violations of the conditions of gas withdrawal as a reason for the cutoff. Gazprom's move comes a day after Latvia said that it will pay in euro rather than the ruble, which the Gazprom had asked for. In March, Putin said that the world's largest natural gas producer will require countries designated as unfriendly in their stance towards Ukraine to pay for piped gas in Russia's currency. Moscow has already cut off gas supplies to Poland, Bulgaria, and Finland. Netherlands and Denmark on Wednesday. Gazprom drastically reduces gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of its capacity. The International Committee of the Red Cross is seeking access to a prisoner facility in eastern Ukraine that was destroyed in what appears to be a missile attack or explosion. The ICRC says that it wants to help evacuate the dead and provide treatment to the wounded. It says that personnel there are in contact with the prisoners' families. The facility is in the front line of the Donetsk province. It was hit on Friday. Pro-Russian forces in Donetsk say 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war were also killed and dozens more wounded. Moscow says Kiev hit the prison with U.S.-made rockets to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. Ukraine says Russia conducted the raid to put the blame on Kiev, calling on the UN and the Red Cross to investigate the incident. And many have denounced the Europe-wide censorship of a Russian-made outlet. Russia Today has intensely hypocritical. However, the European Union's General Court has just denied an appeal by Russia's RT France to upload liberty of the press for all nations. Ramin Mazahari reports.
In a major blow to freedom of the press, the European Union's second highest court has upheld the ban on Russian media outlet RT France for alleged disinformation. Launched in 2017 with a 20 million euro budget and well over 100 employees, RT France burst onto the scene with reporting that the billionaire-dominated French mainstream media refused to touch. Their coverage of the Yellow Vest social revolt won widespread praise, and like Press TV, they rejected the total Western media blackout on the movement, which began in June 2019.
Recueillir l'information.
Providing news is a public service and an obligation of every state. Therefore, it is entirely legitimate for a state to contribute to the budget of medias so that their citizens have balanced, objective information according to their own point of view.
It was no surprise that President Emmanuel Macron was the first leader to call for a Europe-wide ban on Russian state media. The French government then orchestrated the rapid implementation of the ban less than a week after Russia started its military operation in Ukraine.
It's dramatic when you ban alternative news sources, which haven't even broken any laws. There has been no slander or racism or calls for violence, and yet they're denied freedom of expression. It's a dramatic problem for France and Europe, and compounded by the fact that there is absolutely no alternative point of view permitted or available in French media.
The fact that freedom of the press is granted to far-right media such as the Islamophobic Charlie Hebdo magazine, but denied to the Russian people, has already left its impression. The citizens of France and Europe have not been allowed to hear both sides of the long-running conflict in Ukraine. This one-sided media domination has allowed European elite to whip up Russophobia and war hysteria unopposed and provided them with the opportunity to impose unprecedented economic and diplomatic pressure on Moscow. Upon relinquishing the EU's rotating presidency in June, Macron was criticized for saying that the unrest in Ukraine accelerated the bloc's collective agenda. The EU was criticized for once again relying on not democratic means to achieve political ends. A final appeal by RT France to the European Court of Justice is expected to fail as well. In 2012, on the orders of the European Commission, Press TV was removed by top European satellite provider Eutelsat. Last year, the PressTV.com domain was seized and shut down by the United States federal government. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Moving on, Iran's president tells his Chinese counterpart that Tehran supports the One China principle. Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran has always respected the territorial integrity of other countries as a key policy.
Respecting the national sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries is among the fundamental principles of the Islamic Republic of Iran's foreign policy. Within the same framework, backing the One China policy is the principled and definite policy of the Islamic Republic.
During the phone conversation, Raisi also condemned the United States for interference in the internal affairs of other countries. The president said Washington follows a destructive policy of unilateralism, which is now threatening global peace and security. China's Xi Jinping, for his part, said that Iran has played a constructive role in maintaining regional stability. The two countries also discussed ways to speed up the implementation of a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement between Beijing and Tehran. The deal is aimed at strengthening economic policies and political ties between the two countries. Now, the death toll from a recent flood in Iran has risen, that is, to 56, 80 more remain unaccounted for. 21 out of 31 Iranian provinces have been affected by flooding over the past week. The capital, Tehran, was one of the hardest hit. So far, more than 500 people have been housed in emergency shelters across the country. Another 2,500 have been taken to safety. Relief operations are still underway, and floods also caused material damage. They have blocked roads, cutting water and electricity networks in some areas. Flood warnings are still in place in many regions where people are advised to stay off riverbanks and valleys. With the lunar mark of Muharram approaching, Muslims in Indian-controlled Kashmir have begun preparations to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein. Banners with billboards with Imam Hussein's messages have been put up in different parts of the region. Our correspondent Said Ali Safi has more details.
Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, is round the corner. Like in other parts of the world, people here in Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority region in India, are also gearing up for annual Muharram ceremonies. Roads and streets are draped with black flags and banners in remembrance of Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his faithful companions who were massacred in the desert plains of Karbala in 680 AD. Painter and calligrapher Shaukat Ahmad is busy these days, preparing banners to be used in mourning rituals. The banners are in huge demand, as they are the integral part of Muharram ceremonies here. The Imam Bargahs, which are congregation halls for Shia commemoration ceremonies, are also being covered with black sheets and banners. The main Muharram commemorations are held in Imam Bargahs, where Kashmiri Marsiyas, elegiac poems written to commemorate Imam Hussein and his companions, are recited. Also, scholars deliver sermons to highlight the significance of Ashura uprising. Ashura is the 10th day of Muharram when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq 14 centuries ago.
While mourning ceremonies are held in different areas with sizable Shia population, the two major processions in the capital city Srinagar on 8th of Muharram and its 10th day, known as Ashura, were banned by authorities in 1990. Despite repeated pleas by religious and political bodies to lift the ban, the authorities remain unmoved.
The authorities claim the traditional processions in Srinagar pose security threats. The religious bodies and civil activists, on the other hand, term the ban as, quote, blatant breach of religious freedom.
These processions were a symbol of unity, as thousands of Sunnis would participate with Shias in these processions. On the one hand, authorities say that the situation in Kashmir has been back to normal, but on the other hand, they are not allowing such religious processions to take place under the pretext that they would create law and order problems.
The state provides security to Amarnath Yatra that attracts tens of thousands of Hindu pilgrims. And on the other hand, it curbs the historic Muharram processions as well as the celebrations to mark Eid Milad, the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad, in the city center. This speaks volumes about the gross discrimination against the Muslim majority population here.
Every year, despite the clampdown in the region, mourners defy the restrictions and try to carry out the Muharram processions, but they are tear-gassed, cane-charged and detained. With around 1.5 million population, Shias constitute 10% of the total population of India's only Muslim-majority region, which lies at the heart of more than 70 years of hostility between India and Pakistan. Said Ali Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The Venezuelan government vows to challenge a London High Court ruling over the country's gold reserves. They are worth almost $2 billion and held in the Bank of England. The court has a rule that control of these reserves should fall to a board of advisors named by the Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido and not the one appointed by President Nicolas Maduro. After a four-day trial, the judge concluded that the British government recognizes Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. The dispute dates back to 2019, and that is when Guaido, who then headed the National Assembly, swore himself in as the interim leader following Maduro's re-election. Guaido sought control of Venezuelan assets abroad. A law firm representing Venezuela's central bank has called the ruling unfortunate and says the bank is considering an appeal. And Lambert Opeke, former UK Member of Parliament and journalist, joined us earlier. He gave us his take on the court ruling on Venezuela's gold reserves.
I think what we're seeing here is the mixing up of politics and the judiciary. I mean that the West has oftentimes used the legal system to promote its political agenda. It seems to me this has happened here again, and therefore, although you could argue that if the court says it's legal, then it is, I would strongly encourage the Venezuelan authorities to challenge this through appeal. Secondly, motive. What's the motive here? Well, the motive, I think, is the attempt to crush the existing Venezuelan government. And as you've pointed out, and as my colleague has pointed out, the democratically elected leadership of Maduro. You don't have to like a leader to respect democracy. But if you think about it the other way around, imagine if the Venezuelan government tried to bring down a British leader using financial sanctions because they did not like the British leader. I personally believe that this is an Anglo-American initiative primarily.
Tunisian Foreign Ministry has summoned the U.S. Charge d'Affaires over remarks by the American officials criticizing this week's constitutional vote in the African country. The ministry said that it had denounced as unacceptable interference in Tunisia the internal affairs. It said that remarks by the Americans do not reflect the reality of the situation in Tunisia. The country on Monday held a referendum on a new constitution that grants almost unlimited power to the president. 30.5% were eligible to take part. Only of them, nearly 95% said yes to the new constitution. Now, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has voiced concern that the new constitution would weaken Tunisia's democracy. He said that it could erode respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Similar comments were echoed by the ambassadorial nominee, Joey Hood. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Domestic violence is abuse that happens in a personal relationship. Domestic violence affects men and women of any ethnic group, race or religion, rich or poor, teen, adult or elderly. But most of its victims are women. In fact, one out of four women will be a victim at some point. The abuser may use fear, bullying, and threats to gain power and control over the other person. These signs of abuse may happen soon after the start of the relationship and might be hard to notice at first. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Affluent, educated, safe. This is Singapore's public face. But this seemingly ideal country, famously known as the Little Red Dot, has her dark secrets. The unemployment rate stands at less than 5%, and the crime rate is one of the lowest in the world. But other numbers tell a different side of her story. 1 in 10 women in Singapore has experienced physical violence or sexual abuse, and 6 in 10 have endured violence repeatedly. But only a fraction of these victims come forward to the authorities for help. This week on Aperture, we will take a walk into the world of abused spouses in Singapore and follow the journey of 3 abused women to learn of their trauma, hear of their heartbreak, and share their dreams. Stay with us.
When an educated society hears but does not listen,
he would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public.
When victims are shamed into silence.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, oh, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that.
When home is no longer a safe haven, where do these women find the courage to be no longer victims? Singapore, a small island nation with big dreams, where 1 in 4 have a university degree, 90% own a home, the unemployment rate stands at an underwhelming 2%, and over 100,000 millionaires call this home. But behind the numbers, there are secrets best kept hidden.
I thought he would be a good husband. During courtship days, he really took very good care of me. He really doted on me, was very affectionate, very loving. I would say that he went out of his way to accommodate my requests, you know. So there was really no warning signs, you know, that he would change so drastically after marriage.
At 20, Rachel found out she was pregnant.
I think it's more of society's pressure than, you know, because 16 years ago, it's not very acceptable, you know, to be a single mother. And also, I wanted a complete family for my kid. So it was more of an obligation.
Just months into the marriage, the verbal abuse started.
From someone who's very loving to you, you know, who treated you like a queen, you know, put you on a pedestal, and then, you know, suddenly that someone actually tells you, know, that you are the reason why he lost his job, you know, because of certain superstition, or you know your birthday clash, you know, that kind of thing, and it's all your fault, and then how can you put on so much weight after pregnancy? I didn't sign up for that, you know, and I can't even bear to look at you now.
This was the start of Rachel's 8-year ordeal of living with an abusive husband. She was 5 months pregnant with her first child.
We were having an argument. I was defending my point of view. And then he just snapped and he just shoved me.
Abandoned, shocked, betrayed, Rachel struggled with all these emotions.
I think most importantly is that I really didn't want to accept the fact that, you know, he was like that, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be moving on. And given the fact that, you know, we are already married and we have a child on the way, you know, I felt very trapped.
Money and the lack of close family support also reduced her options.
Emotionally, it was because my parents didn't like him. So it was a case of, like, you know, I told you so. Back then, the laws didn't allow divorcees to buy their own house, so housing would be an issue. Also, in terms of financially, I wonder if I would be able to support the child on my own.
Rachel hoped the baby would change him, make him softer, happier. But the stresses of first-time parenthood quickly dispelled her illusions.
Things got actually worse when the baby kept crying. You know, he would scream at me and ask me, you know, oh, what kind of mother are you? Don't even know how to take care of your own kid. I don't see other people's babies screaming or crying like that, you know.
His anger reached a boiling point after he lost his job and the family became reliant on Rachel's income.
He perceived it as some kind of attack on his manhood. And given the fact that I gradually earned more than him over the years, it didn't bode well for our relationship.
A few drinks, a perceived disobedience, and the cycle would start again.
He was hitting me, he was raining blows on me, and I fell over the wrong way. Yeah, I actually hit my back actually hit against the side of the coffee table. Yeah, and I just fell over. Yeah, so my back was thrown at a very unnatural angle.
Hours flowed into days, weeks into months. Months into years. But all roads still led headfirst into a brick wall.
I really lost count. I've been in A&E for my slip disc. I thrown up my back, various kind of bleeding, head injuries. I had to go for CT scan, MRIs.
All this time, Rachel chose to hide her pain and lead a double life.
Sometimes I feel like such a fraud, you know. Obviously, at home, I'm going through all these things, you know, and I already feel very injured. Injured not only physically, you know, emotionally. Feel very betrayed, you know. Feel very angry. And you have to hide all that, you know, because during work, you know, I had to be very professional, okay? And I don't want to bring my personal life into my professional life, you know, and to maintain that kind of professional respect, you know, the kind of facade that I have to put up.
On average in Singapore, 3,000 spousal abuse cases are reported each year. But family violence specialists believe this represents just the tip of the iceberg.
We also know that less than 10% of women who have experienced abuse come forward to the formal helping agencies, whether it's the police or whether it's the family service centre. So what prevents these people from getting help?
One key reason why Rachel stayed with her husband for as long as she did was for her children, who never saw their father beating their mother.
While he wasn't a good husband, he was a good father. So I was very conflicted. While I had to take care of myself, I also have to consider the feelings of my daughter. You know, I didn't want her to have a broken family. I really tried to make things work. There was a lot of self-doubt. Am I too strong? Should I be more docile? Should I be more submissive? Should I be more gentle?
All her doubts were finally erased one night.
I was sleeping, you know, he just pulled me out of bed and, you know, he was hitting me. And my elder daughter actually came out of her room. She was very, very shocked when she saw what was going on. She was very brave. She tried to protect me, so she was trying to pull him off me. At that point, I think he was very infuriated, you know. So he didn't realize it was her, so he just flung her off. She was thrown against the wall. That was really the last straw for me, that she was being physically thrown off like that. It just made me snap in a way that I realized that, you know, it had to stop right there and then.
The very next day, Rachel and her two daughters moved out. Her husband immediately tried to apply for a personal protection order against her, saying that she had injured him during the fight.
The officer who processed the case, when he called me up to investigate the matter, you know, I actually showed him the reports, the medical reports, you know, and the different police reports I made over the years, you know, and I showed it to him. I mean, just look, and what do you think? So that case was actually thrown out.
She filed for divorce the very same week, but it took 2 years before the case was settled. Rachel gave up on alimony in exchange for full custody of their children.
I've always told them that whatever happened between me and their father, it's between the adults, and I mean, it's very difficult for me to say this, but I always told them, you know, that they shouldn't hate him. They are entitled to feel anger, of course, and to work on that anger, you know. But I don't want them to hate him.
The International Violence Against Women survey that we completed in 2010 was done because we felt that up to that point, as a country, as a nation, we had no idea as to the prevalence of violence against women nationwide. And we found that 9.2%, or 1 out of 10 women that we surveyed, reported they experienced physical violence and or sexual abuse from their partners.
The survey used a sample size of 2,000 women aged 18 to 60 years old and asked very specific questions. Have you been slapped, punched, and strangled? Has sex been forced upon you against your will? And out of those 1 in 10 women who answered yes, another number came to light.
More than half of them said it has happened more than once. 3 times, 6 times, you know. So we're not talking about people who, on the first instance of violence, you know, begin to go to the police or shout for help and all that.
When is domestic violence a public issue? Who has a right to intervene? Why do victims remain silent?
It's not a slap or two. I was really getting beaten up badly in public, in the house, and I still kept quiet and smiled.
Power. Control. Dominance. These are the driving forces behind domestic violence. Shame. Fear. Isolation. These are the shackles holding victims in place. Family, children, a happy ever after. This is what Mira hoped for when she married her first love.
We had really good chemistry. I mean, he spoke very, very well. He made me laugh.
In the first year of marriage, when Mira was 7 months pregnant, the violence kicked in.
He used vulgarities on me, calling me a and I answered him back, and that's when he kicked my head like it was a football and stepped on my head. I screamed for help. I tried to open the door as I got up, screaming for my mother-in-law to help. He pulled my hair back, continued to beat me up even more. And after that, he told me why he beat me up, made it my fault, and I had to go down and apologize to my mother-in-law and say it's my fault.
The day Mira's son was born, she saw a flicker of hope.
The day I gave birth, he was awesome. That's when I felt that amazing man I married. He was there throughout the time I was in labor and all. After that, things changed completely because that night itself, drank, came back, being in the hospital. Basically, I was abused terribly as I was practically bedridden in bed. Vulgarities, everything. So it became a weekly affair, you could say, of getting abused physically, emotionally, mentally.
Mira's husband had a temper, and he wasn't shy about showing it wherever and whenever his buttons were pushed.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public. Imagine, he beat me up among the clubs in Serangoon Road, dragged me on the road and all. And when someone tried to come and help me, and he told the guy, this is my wife, you don't touch her, you don't have any right to touch her. Nobody helped me. Everyone just watched the fun.
When Mira's husband lost his temper, it wasn't just a slap or a shove.
He's a very strong guy. He never beat me like it was a woman giving a slap. He beat me up like a guy. 2 fractures, a bleeding nose, multiple bruises to the head, multiple bruises to the thighs, to the back, an extremely swollen rib for a good 2 weeks. Name it, been there, done that. And yeah, the last one, permanent scar for life, a slash on the face.
Beyond the physical abuse, what cut us deeply were the relentless emotional attacks that shattered her self-esteem.
Emotionally, what he would do is this. He abused me in front of his mom, his maid, his friends. He called me a prostitute. He says I'm a lousy mother. I'm a lousy wife. I should be grateful that he married me, that, you know, I'm living with his family and all that, and food is there and all. I should feel grateful.
We've come across many cases where you have both emotional violence as well as physical violence. And what is really striking is that when a victim relates what she remembers of the incidents, it's very often it's the emotional violence, it's the words used that, you know, actually has the deepest scars.
Mira believes her family would have intervened strongly had they known what was going on, but she chose to hide the abuse from them.
I didn't want to involve my family because I didn't want my family to look down on him. I wanted my marriage to work. Nobody gets married thinking, okay, fine, I get married today and when am I going to divorce? Nobody does that. Marriage is sacred. A man and woman gets married, they have children, they go to work, they bring up their kids, and you know, they see their kids through teen years and all that. That's life. And that's what I wanted. Why I stuck through is not just simply because of marriage. I really loved him.
Although her family did not know about the abuse initially, her husband's family did. But they chose to turn a blind eye.
My mother-in-law saw me get abused. She watched me get abused. He's got three other siblings. I did seek help, crying to his sisters, younger one and older one. Younger one was very much more empathetic towards me. But they felt that they couldn't do anything about it because he was beyond control. I was always told that it's, you know, it's in my hands to change him.
By the end of their first year of marriage, Mira had obtained a personal protection order, or PPO. If her husband is violent against her, he can be fined up to $2,000, jailed up to 6 months, or both. But the PPO does have its limitations. It's not a restraining order which would prevent the abusive spouse from coming near or having contact with the victim.
The perpetrator could follow the victim to work, could call the victim all the time, send her SMSs, you know, multiple SMSs to harass her, could sort of always be within sight of the victim but not actually physically touch her. So all of these things can be intimidating, very, very annoying, disruptive to the victim's life still. And in other countries, the court has the power to actually restrict and to prohibit the perpetrator from carrying out these acts. I think those kinds, the court should actually have wider powers to make such orders in Singapore as well.
Despite the PPO, the threats continued. 10 months later, Mira moved back to her parents' house for the third time. Her husband turned up at the company where she worked.
He came to my office and he humiliated me. He was drunk in the morning, calling me the CBD in front of everyone, lunchtime.
A few days later, he broke into her mother's apartment at 6 in the morning.
He broke into my home with a knife and a brick. I had my siblings, my brother, my son and all there. He pinned me down as I had my son in my arms. He slashed me behind my ear, on my face. I was screaming. Everyone was awake in my home. It was chaos. My sister-in-law, my sister and all helped me. They took my son away. I ran out of the home. I thought he was going to come after me with a knife, but he didn't. All he did was say that he just wanted to disfigure me and leave.
Mira's husband was arrested and sentenced to more than 6 months in prison. He has just been released.
If he's going to try and come back, I would just do the simple thing. I'll call the police. I mean, I have a PPO, so I will call the police and all. And he knows that if he's going to try and come back, it's going to be even a tougher sentence this time. During my marriage, I was really afraid and I lived in fear. So at this point of time, I'm very confident. I don't need to feel afraid anymore.
Waiting, watching, standing still. More often than not, this is the norm, not the exception.
So I think Singaporeans make very good bystanders. I think that's something that is part of our conditioning.
We are a society where we are peace-loving, law-abiding, and we generally let the authority take care of a problem.
I think that this is a function of, one, Singapore being a fast-paced urban country where there people may not have as much time for each other. There may not be that much trust between strangers. And there is a certain attitude that we should each mind our own business.
How does the law define spousal violence? What happens to cases which don't meet the legal criteria? How do we help the most vulnerable victims?
Yes, we don't have anything. A person is like a vacuum, a vacuum. If you leave, you go back to where you are happy, a child is separated, can't see it.
5.2 million people live in Singapore today. Over 2 million of them are foreigners. Drawn here by dreams of wealth, the promise of work, and the hope of love. In recent years, approximately 40% of marriages in Singapore have been between a citizen and a foreigner.
One in three of the women that are presented with issues of spousal violence are actually foreign wives. And this was actually an increase from the previous years, where it was one in five of every woman that came forward to seek help.
Love, convenience, citizenship. There are many reasons why foreign women marry Singaporean men. But one common theme recurs in these relationships.
So generally what we hear from our foreign wives is that there's a sense of fear that they're often threatened by their husbands. That at the end of the day, if they are going to report, for example, about the spousal violence incidents, they're going to be sent back to their home countries. And then they risk not able to see their children or maybe even lose custody of their children because of their citizenship or legal right to be in Singapore.
This has been Vu's story since she came to Singapore.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله, everyone, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. I am honored and highly privileged to be here at your service. Right in the place where we shall find some clues for a better life. So open your hearts and let's start the journey. But just so you know, I would hereby officially announce that I have no intention to play the teacher or the lecturer. I sit around the same table as you are. So the purpose of this program is to share some ideas as well as having some hints on some very interesting stuff. Therefore, it's going to be a session in which we are going to add a little bit of taste of literature into it. As I just told you, in today's episode of For a Better Life, we are going to talk about literature and religion and how they affect each other. Perhaps words are the greatest inventions of human beings, without which we are incapable of conveying our meanings. What we are today and what we will be tomorrow is an outcome of everything we have as our literary heritage, which includes our historical, political, and more importantly, religious background. We would have never known great heroes and their histories if there were no papers to capture the moments in forms of words, and obviously there would have never been a growth or evolution in human thought in case there was no books to remind us everything that happens in the history of humankind. So clearly literature is the device that carries the past and gives it a tongue to speak of itself. Through the course of history, authors used their words to write, and at the very same time they shared everything they believed in. In the old ages, where there were no means of literacy, people had primitive thoughts. They had a need to worship a god, but very little knowledge to find to one. That's why they created gods of their own. They were mostly pagan, and it really was the dark age of human history. The process of enlightenment took time, and as Islam flourished, great pamphlets started to appear beside our holy book that contains all the secrets of human essence. Little by little and very gradually, those words traveled on papers, and literature helped religion to bloom everywhere. Even in the modern age of speed and technology, it is our literature that introduces to other nations in forms of book, in shelves or libraries, or the ideas that are shared in any other platforms. So this was all just the introduction. Let's go for a little break and we'll be back in no time to capture the rest of the ideas that we're going to have together. Allah, Allah, Subhanallah, Allah, Allah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en. If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
Well, this is For a Better Life, and I am Asma, your humble host. Well, we were talking about religion and literature. I would say that throughout the course of history, it was literature that brought us everything that existed in our heritage and the historical background of our religion. So we could say that it has been a device that helped us understand our religion more and more, and of course, better than ever. So if we start talking about Islamic literature, we would say that there is a vast ocean of information about that. We have so much of books that contain poetry, that contain knowledge, that contain so much of different forms of literature that has came to us in order to enlighten us. So the most important literature that belongs to Islamic heritage is the literature of Ashura. There, as you of course know, There's plenty of poetry and plenty of stories that have been done regarding the story of Kerala and the great tragedy that happened there. Of course, I don't like to call it a tragedy because tragedy usually is lesser than what happened in Kerala. So let's call it the massacre because it is going to share the idea better and better. So it had some hints of tragedy in it, but of course it was a massacre that happened to the son of the prophet. Now, throughout the history, many people, many poets, many writers have used their talent in writing some poems and some stories in order to keep that memory alive. Well, we all know that it already stays alive no matter if we try or not, because it is the promise of Allah for that idea to keep growing and blooming everywhere. And as we go further in time, we see that it already is blooming because it is the act of God and because the blood that has been shed there has been so worthy and so valuable that it is not going to cease to exist or be forgotten everywhere. So we got to the point that literature that belongs to the story of Kerala is very vast and it has got so much different forms in it. And as we go further, maybe in past it was more traditional and now it's getting to go through a more frequent language, more common language. The language has changed, but still the main idea is the same. So, dear listeners, I hope you're not tired. So, in case you feel any tired, then go for a sip of water. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back in no time. Welcome back to A Better Life. Well, we were talking about literature, our Islamic heritage that contains so much of poetry and writings. So the first time, perhaps, the people started to say poetries, to compose poetries regarding the story of Karbala, was right after that incident itself, when that great massacre occurred and the people were back from that travel, as you know. Well, just like today, just like nowadays that we have reporters that would report the wars or anything that happens all around the world, back in time, there used to be some people who reported whatever incident happened in different battlefields. So when these reporters were back after that war, they started to write and compose about what happened in there. Now, those compositions, those writings were more of authentic storytelling, just whatever they have seen. But gradually, as it came to be heard by those who were in love with their beloved Imam, who has been massacred and slaughtered, they started to compose poetries, which contained so much of passions and, as I told you, devotion, which is very important. And then, throughout this very process of emotion and passion getting together with this very sad event, so much of beautiful and rich poems were created in Arabic language, in Persian language, in so much of different languages. And as it grew to travel through different parts of the world, even in other languages, people have started to compose poetries about that or write different stories about that. So I guess this is all the time that we got for today's episode. We talked about literature of Ashura and we understood that there are so much of poetries and so much of writings regarding that very sorrowful massacre that occurred in our history. And still, people are composing so much of poems and writings, which are so passionate and full of devotion and purity. Thank you for staying tuned. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every
closed hand in us. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us. Every thought I have and every word I share.
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.